there's two problems with the starting the change in the world. The change in the world is not unique to you. Everyone can see it. Your competitors can see it. They're probably reacting to the same change. So what? The change in the world usually starts with data is growing exponentially every year. It's like, no, Sherlock. We're selling a database here. Everybody knows that. The second thing is, you know, I worked with many companies. They just had a better way of doing something. And that was it. And so trying to force that into this change paradigm didn't make any sense. What we really wanted to do is start with our insight into the problem.
Welcome to Behind the Product, a podcast by SAP, where we believe it takes more than a great idea to make a great product. We've been around for over 30 years, building software that matters more. And we've set out to explore the people, practices, and philosophies to try and capture what's behind great software products. So join us on this journey of conversation with the folks that bring ideas to life. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Our guest today is April Dunford. She's the founder of Ambient Strategy, the author of Sales Pitch and Obviously Awesome, among many other things. She is probably most known for her expertise in market positioning and has personally launched 16 products with tremendous impact on many others. I met April at Industry last year that I attended with a colleague, Josh Coulter. I asked Josh to be my co-host for this show because of his familiarity with April's work, and in his role as CEO of Cardboard, he's often working on the positioning of that product. And the three of us had a great conversation that included some spicy takes on a couple of topics. You're really going to enjoy this one. Before we dive in, as always, if you think there's one person who might enjoy our show, please consider sharing it with them or share some feedback for me. You can send me a note at podcast@sap.com. All right, let's get to it. Hope you enjoy. I want to chat a little bit about Sales Pitch, obviously, because that was my introduction to you. I know, Josh, you've been a follower of April's work for a long time, and I went back and read Obviously Awesome. Oh, it's right there. I can see it in the background.
It's here so that I can do this gag visually.
Yes. Ooh, nice. Let's just get this out of the way. Everybody go read both of April Dunford's books. They are both fantastic. But Sales Pitch was my introduction to you. Saw your talk at Industry last year. Josh and I were at that conference together.
I love that conference. It's one of my favorites.
It's really good.
It's so good.
What I love about it most, well, okay, there's two things I really love about the conference. I've been three times over the last 4 years or so. I feel like there's always great people, and it's not a ton of people, and it's a single track conference. I don't have to decide.
I love single track conference.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want to go see this, and I kind of want to go see this at the same time. I have to choose. You're just hanging out in one big room together for the most part, the two or three days that you're there. So absolutely.
And the speakers are great. Like, they do a really good job. Like, I think they're very thoughtful about how they pick the speakers. I've spoken there twice now. And the first time they asked me to speak, I was like, oh man, I have arrived.
I love it.
I was like, oh, this is it. I'm taking this off the bucket list. And finally asked me to come speak at Industry. I literally prepped like a maniac for that one too. I was like, I'm going to go in there and go smash that.
I thought your talk was awesome. Well, I'm not just saying that. Seriously.
Thank you.
It was informative and compelling. I feel like that the art of being able to balance those two things is really hard.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. If we talk about the talk in the context of Sales Pitch, if you had to give somebody who's not familiar with anything you've talked about, as far as like positioning and any of the marketing awesomeness that you've talked about, what would be the 60-second overview? How would you give somebody a quick snapshot?
Here's what it is. In most tech companies in particular, I work with tech companies. If you look what's going on the marketing side, marketing is really sweating how we talk about the product. They got copywriters. We're A-B testing all the words. We're sweating it. Every little word, we're like, ooh, it's got to be perfect. And then we generate a lead and it goes over to sales. And what's happening over in sales? They ain't sweating any of that. They're like, we're giving you a product walkthrough. We have 5 drop-down menus. Allow me to click on every single one and describe everything in every single drop-down menu. And so the opportunity that we are missing here in the sales side, in my opinion, is we operate in a first sales call. Our job there is to just simply expose the product and let the customer make up their own mind about whether that product is what they want or not. when in fact, what the customer is trying to figure out is, why pick you over the other guys? And we are simply not answering that question at all. So the work that I'm doing on the positioning side, I started out working on positioning with, how do we get to the answer to that question? Why pick you over the other guys? But then what I was finding is, if we didn't build a sales pitch that mapped to that, that would work over in marketing. But the minute it hit sales, sales is just showing the product, just the facts, Jack. They're not even attempting to answer the question or reflect any of that positioning in the sales pitch. So my second book is about, how do we build a pitch that does what sales needs to do, allows us to expose prospects to the product, but also really effectively answers the question, hey, this is why you should pick us. This is how we're different and better than everybody else.
That is an awesome, concise way to explain what I've read of your book so far. The thing that I loved about it was that it's not just a, okay, if you get asked this question, here's how you answer it. It's not a script. There's a process to it. There's a framework for it. It's about telling a story.
Yeah.
I read a book a few years ago called Story Mythos, and it was a guy who was the chief historian for Procter & Gamble. During his life, he would write screenplays for movies and TV shows, and that was just a thing that he did on the side.
Most of the books written about storytelling come from people that have a background in film.
I did not know that.
It's so true, though.
That makes a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. It was this idea of bring narrative forward, I'm oversimplifying it, but bring the narrative forward when you're talking about anything related to business, whether it's B2B, B2C, sales, product marketing, or whatever it is. There's a story here because that's the most compelling thing that people understand. And I thought it was very interesting that you talk about, we're going to answer this one question, but I'm going to walk you through some details and some elements before we get to that point so that it all connects.
Right.
Because if you focus to just facts, that doesn't really help me understand how that impacts my life, impacts my business in a positive way. How am I going to benefit from buying your thing? Not even just, are you better than the other guy, but what does it actually mean to me? I love that part of it. Have you found that this, because you talk about in sales pitch, how it's not just about sales. It can be your marketing website. It can be case studies. It can be applied to other things. Have you had any instances where this can be applied to makers, whether they're an engineer or a designer or somebody that are more behind the scenes of maybe a product company? Do you think that can help them communicate internally?
The short answer is, I think so. The longest answer is, that's not really what this stuff was built for.
Yeah, fair.
One of the big things I think about is, you know, when we're building a story, where do the components of the story come from? We have inputs to the story. And in my thinking, the inputs are the basic component pieces of positioning. Like if I'm going to tell you a story about my product and why you should pay attention to it and why it's good and maybe you should consider buying it, there's a bunch of things that I need as inputs to tell that story. So I need to understand who's the audience for the story. In sales, that's who's my target customer. And then what do they care about? The guts of this story is going to be woven around, what can I do for that customer that no one else can? Which means I got to define the no one else too. Who's the competition? What do I do better than them? What is the value I can deliver better than anybody else? And then who's my audience? So who am I communicating this to? So in my mind, you need to kind of figure out these piece parts first, which in my definition, that's your positioning. Those are the piece parts of your positioning. So I think that works internally as well as it does externally. You'd be thinking about, who's my audience? What's the value here? What are the alternatives? Like if they say no to me, what are they saying yes to? So what's the value I'm trying to get them to understand? And can I weave a story around that that says, look, you could do it this other way, you know, and that's choice. And here's the pluses and minuses with that. But we kind of took this approach. Here's why we did. And here's the value we think that's going to give you. And we use that as the setup before we get to the facts. We're trying to sort of explain, why did we choose to do it the way we did it? And I think a good story gives you a bit of that. It's not just the facts. It's the context around it. If I just show you the end result, you maybe don't understand it. And you certainly don't understand, well, why is it different than if I chose to take this other path or do it a different way? That kind of gets you to the same place, doesn't it? And you have to explain to me, like, no, actually, man, it does not. And here's why. Here's why we chose to do it this way. You might disagree with us, but at least you understand why we made the decisions we made.
There's a lot of nuance in that. I'm really curious, as you've worked with different companies and different folks to start to implement some of these practices and this approach, what do you find that people really struggle with to adopt?
Yeah, there's so much.
The top three.
So let me give you some really basic ones that you would think are not struggling things, but if you get them wrong, everything's bad. The first one is most companies are not super clear on who they compete with. You would think.
That's a little surprising.
Yeah, it's surprising. And this has been a surprise to me, actually. And it's funny how consistent it is with almost every company I work with. We have a very heated discussion about who's the competition. We think about competition differently in different contexts. In the product management group in particular, when they think about competition, they are thinking about our current competition, but they are also thinking about what I would call horizon competitors. So competitors that they don't really compete with us now, but they're on the road to competing with us. We know what's going on. We expect to see them in a couple of years. And we got to worry about them when we're building the roadmap and where things are going. And they don't spend, depending on the company, a lot of them don't spend a lot of product management folks are not spending a lot of time thinking about status quo as competition. But it absolutely is. Now, if I think about this in a sales context, I got product on the truck today. It competes with folks today. I'm trying to do deals today, right now. Forget about the future. We're lucky if we survive to that, man. How am I going to sell the crap I got right now against the competitors I got right now? That is a different set of competitors. So when we think about positioning and building a good sales pitch, and answering this question, why pick us versus the other guys? We're not talking about the other guys 5 years from now. We're talking about the other guys right now. And even more specifically, if a competitor does not land on a short list with a prospect, it's a ghost, man. I don't have to worry about competing against things that my customers don't put on a short list. So if I ask sales, who do we compete with? They give me the short list. And that is a different list than what I get from product management. And then it's a different list for marketing too, because if you ask marketing, marketing's really focused on marketing. So they'll name competitors that are blowing their brains out with giant marketing budgets and they're all over the place. And we may or may not see them in sales. Marketing will say, oh my God, we got to worry about so-and-so. They're everywhere. They're all over my keywords. They're all over my stuff. They're absolutely killing me everywhere. And then you go over to sales and they're like, never heard of them. Don't have to worry about them. So there's that. Now, if you go to sales and say, who do we compete with? They don't necessarily give you the right answer either, because they'll talk about the short list. But we know the data tells us that 40 to 60% of B2B purchase processes end in no decision. Now, some of those no decisions are actually a vote for the status quo. Salesperson will never say, oh, our competitor is Excel. But we're losing a lot of deals to Excel.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
In the positioning, we have to take that into account. So for the purposes of a positioning exercise, we need to position against anything a customer would realistically do if we didn't exist, which means status quo or anything that lives on a short list, and that's it. So a lot of mushy, not great positioning comes from companies trying to position against too many things that they don't actually have to position against at all, or they're completely forgetting about their main competitor, which is hire an intern. Or do it with pen and paper. Yeah. And so the companies out there saying, hey, like you should pick our stuff because it's easy to use. But it, you know, the prospect's looking at you going, you know what's easy to use, man? The intern is easy to use. Yeah.
Like, I'm already paying for Excel. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, like way we go. So that's the first most common mistake is we don't know who we're up against. Or we don't have a clear picture. We're not looking at it the way a customer looks at it. And so our positioning is off because we're trying to position against things that the customer's not even thinking about, or we're missing things that the customer is seriously considering. So now our positioning is bad. Our positioning is bad. The sales pitch is bad. The positioning is the input to the sales pitch. So we're crafting this big story and the customer is like, yeah, but why wouldn't I just use my intern? And you don't have an answer for that.
Wow.
That's the most common place I see this getting screwed up, is just the starting point is wrong. And because the what do we have to beat in order to win a deal, or what do we have to position against is wrong, and everything downstream from that is wrong. I didn't expect that. When I started doing this work, like back when I was in-house VP marketing, I knew we bumped into that a little bit, right? That product would see it one way, sales would see another. But I didn't realize how bad the problem was until I'd done, you know, as a consultant, like 100 of these things. And you're like, man, this is really the place where everybody has missed there. And then the second thing, of course, is we're tech companies. We love talking about features. It's a lot harder to stay oriented on value. But we really need to, like, a great sales pitch is making the case for you should pick us because there's a thing we can do for your business that the other solutions cannot. Not pick us because I got a whiz-bang AI thing. Like, who cares? Why do I care about that? We're just not orienting enough around value, and we're too deep on features, not deep enough on value, which is why we get this product walkthrough demo instead of a sales pitch, right? We're just trying to expose you to all the features because there's this idea that you will know how to translate those features into value. If I just show it to you, you'll understand why it's great. You'll understand why it's different from the other folks. You'll just know. The reality is customer doesn't. Like, we need to get way more explicit around value and making the case for you should pick us because we can do this valuable thing that other folks can't.
Such a good point.
I have a question for you. One thing that sets your sales pitch method apart is how the pitch starts. And I love a couple of the examples that you use in the book. And you know, I think about how Challenger customer talks about leading with insight, or Andy Raskin talks about nailing the change to the rules of the game. And I found it personally very hard when crafting a pitch to really nail that first lead and insight. And so I'm curious how you help your clients find their unique insight to start their pitch without falling into obvious market trends. You know, here's a big trend that's going on in the world that everyone else could lay claim to.
This is what I don't like about this starting with the change in the world thing. Well, there's two problems with the starting the change in the world. One is often the change in the world is obvious. The change in the world is not unique to you. Everyone can see it. Your competitors can see it. They're probably reacting to the same change. So what? You know, like the change in the world usually starts with data is growing exponentially every year. It's like, no, Sherlock. We're selling a database here. Everybody knows that. That's one thing. The second thing is that, you know, I worked with many companies where their differentiated value wasn't about a change in the world. They just had a better way of doing something. And that was it. And so trying to force that into this change paradigm didn't make any sense. What we really wanted to do is start with our insight into the problem, our unique insight into the problem. It was like, we'd look at this a different way. Everybody else is solving it this way, but you know, we're experts in this. And when we dug into it, we noticed this thing. And we know this, our competitors don't. So they built theirs one way, we chose a different path. And that different path results in very different value. The difference, I would say, and this is, by the way, very Challenger, is that when I learned Challenger, like back when I was at IBM, we did Challenger Sale, and I love that. But what I noticed was if I was doing to the letter Challenger Sale, you know, and I think because it came out of doing big, big deals, there was this idea in Challenger that I'm going in there, and I'm trying to sell you $10 million worth of software, and you don't have $10 million because all your money is already allocated other places. And so if I'm going to convince you to do a $10 million deal with me, I got to convince you that there is a big chunky thing that you don't see that is actually true. And I got to really kill you with that thing to get you to open your mind that, oh, dude, this is bad. And I'm going to have to dedicate $10 million to fixing it. And so in Challenger Sale, like to the letter Challenger Sale, there's a step in Challenger Sale. I always loved how they named this step. It was called rational drowning. And so the step in Challenger Sale was I come in with this insight and said, hey, I know something about your business you don't know. It's this. And the customer goes, what? No, that can't be true. And then you drown them within the proof that it is true. And so at IBM, we had like a whole team of people and all they were doing was research and all this stuff. So we could come and go, here's a fact, here's a fact, here's a fact, here's a fact. And you're like, no, stop drowning me with this. And the idea is we might spend the entire first sales call hitting you with that and not even get to the rest of it. We're just trying to get you to open your mind to the idea that Maybe you've been looking at this wrong. Now, what I experienced when I left IBM, I went to a company where our average deal size was 30K, 30 to 150K was our average deal size. And we were selling a thing that people just didn't think about all that much. And so when we came in, we could come in with the insight and basically just click the flashlight on it and say, have you ever thought about that? Crap, no, I haven't thought about that. And we're like, well, let me tell you, we thought about it a lot. And we looked at it and we dug into the data and here's what we see. And we realized if customers like you understood this, you would think about the solution to that differently. And that's it. I don't have to spend all day here. I don't have to rationally drown you. I just got to make the case for it. And so in most of the SaaS businesses that I've worked with, and even the non-SaaS ones, and you're doing deals that are maybe 100K, 50K, 150K, I don't actually have to rationally drown you, but I do have to lead with my insight into the market, which is, hey, we all agree we want to solve this problem, right? We all agree on that. But what we found out, you know, because we're deep on this problem, is we found out there's a problem inside the problem. And all the other solutions on the market don't take that into consideration. And we do. Now let's look at what that means. So all the other solutions in the market, you could go this way and it's good for this, bad for this. You could go this way, good for this, bad for this. But because we've taken this other approach, we can unlock this value that the other guys can't. So what I like about that is a whole bunch of things. One, from the very beginning of the sales pitch, I am starting with something that is unique to me. So now it's not my, you know, change in the world, you know, data is increasing, whatever that is. That's not unique to me. Any of my competitors can see that that change is happening and start talking about that. It's not unique to me. But if my insight into the market is because my product is unique. So coming to your question, how do we come up with that? Like, what if we didn't actually build the product around that insight? Because sometimes that's what happens. Like we built the product for something else, and then it turns out people use it for this, and then fast forward it a bit, and one founder is gone, and whatever, you know, startups are messy. So really what we do is we reverse engineer it from our differentiated value. Let me give you an example. So an example I use in the book is these guys, Level Jump. They've now been acquired by Salesforce. So if you go look for them, you'll just get the Salesforce page. They're doing this sales enablement software. So it's software for training your sales reps, getting a new sales rep up to speed. Terrible market, all kinds of venture-backed competitors in that space, super, super, super crowded. So we did the positioning work. And in the positioning work, their differentiated capability was there were all these other solutions on the market, but they were the only one built on Salesforce. So then you ask the question, so what? What's the value of that? And at the beginning, it wasn't clear. Like at the beginning, like the team had lots of opinions about that. Like some folks were like, oh, well, it's you don't have to log out of that and log into another system. You just stay right in the thing. And one is like, well, you can deliver the training right where it's needed, which is in the thing. But what the real, real value was of that is you could measure with sales metrics, because it's all the same data underneath, the impact of the sales enablement. So did it improve time to first deal? Did it improve time to make quota? That's a really big deal. So then you think about it and you're like, well, isn't that funny? You can't do that with any of the other solutions at all. And that sounds really important. If I'm the head of sales enablement, how do I prove to my boss that that thing that I do is worth anything? So we just bring that to the front. So the insight is, hey, man, why are we doing sales enablement in the first place? Because every day your rep's not trained, every day your rep doesn't make quota costs you money.
Yes, true.
And again, I didn't have to rationally drown you with that. The minute I tell you that, you're like, you're right. Yeah, that's why we're doing it. The faster we can get them up to speed, the more money we make. All right. Can we all agree? Yeah, we all agree. Okay, let's look at all your other sales enablement choices. Can you measure that with any of the other ones? But you want that. Wouldn't that be a good thing to be able to do that? We're the only ones that do that. That's not a change in the world. That's not. It's me. Everybody else is looking at the problem of how do I efficiently roll out training to my salespeople, not how do I effectively train salespeople. And I can only answer that question if I know whether or not it works. So that's how we do it. We look at the differentiated value and we ask ourselves, what does a prospect need to understand in order to understand why the value we can deliver that no one else can is really, really super important. And if you nail that, you nail the whole pitch.
It's hard to think back to you earlier in your career. If I transition for just a second.
What do you mean? It's not hard for me.
Listening to you talk about this, though, it just blows my mind. I've read some interviews with you where early in your career, when you transitioned from an in-house marketer to like a fractional marketer, you said you really struggled.
Oh, it was stupid.
With building your own positioning consulting. And so I'm kind of curious, knowing what you know now, how would you apply this approach to other professional services that don't have a niche?
Here's the way I like to think about it. I think I did the same thing everybody does when they make the switch from being in-house to consulting. They'll say, I'll just do the thing that I was doing in-house. I'll just do it for multiple companies at once. I have three clients and then I'll make three times the money. That's what everybody thinks. And of course, that's not how it works at all. Instead of thinking, you know, I just did that as a starting point because I thought, well, you know, I'll just get some things and then I'll just see how that works out. And the answer to how did that work out is it worked terrible. And why did it work terrible? Because there's 1,000 fractional CMOs out there and we're all the same. Why pick me over the other guys? You picked me because you knew me. You picked me because you were in my network. You know, you picked me because I had a reputation with people I know, but outside people I know, why would they ever pick me? They wouldn't. So there's no specialization. There's no nothing. So in the work I've done with services businesses, everybody starts like that because you've got to make money. Like, you know, you're taking your victim where you find them at the beginning. You're just, you know, you're just getting out there. You're just trying to make some money, whatever you're doing. But then at some point, you know, you've proven that you can run a business. You're okay at selling stuff. But then you got to think to get to the next level, you got to think about, well, what am I really good at? What can I do that the other people can't? And in my case, it was, I had done all this positioning work when I was in-house. I had a methodology that I was using when I was in-house. I wasn't exactly sure how to package that up and sell it as a consulting engagement. So that took me a couple of years to figure that out. But once I cracked the code on that, everything was great. But I think in the services businesses I've worked with, we'll say, okay, well, what are the alternatives to you? And they'll say, well, there's other services businesses like this, and some of them fall into this category, and some of them fall into this category, and then there's big ones and there's small ones. And then you say, well, what do you got that the others don't have? And you really need to investigate that. Like, what are you good at? Why should someone pick you over everyone else? What's the thing you got that is kind of rare in your competitor set? And then what's the value of that? And so in my case, it was, well, I can teach you this thing, how to do positioning. And the value of that is actually massive because most of the companies that I work with, they've been thrashing on their positioning for like a year. Like, what if I give you that year back and we're going to do it in a week? What's that worth to you? It's worth a lot of money. So I could charge a lot of money for that as a service.
I wish I would have met you about 10 years ago in my career. That's amazing.
Yeah. Like even me, like I came out and I just wasn't thinking about it. I was just like, I just need to get some clients, man. And so people would say, well, what do you do? And I'm like, marketing stuff. What do you need? You know, and that's the wrong way to build a business. I'm like, what do you need? And they'd be like, well, maybe you could do some messaging for us. I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, no, I should not be writing messaging for anybody. Like, I mean, I'm an engineer. I'm like, I don't even, like, you should be hiring a copywriter for that. But I just said yes to a whole bunch of stuff just to get going. And then after a year of that, I was like, okay, this needs to stop. And then I was like, well, how do I get focused on something that I'm better than all the other fractional CMOs on? Because there's thousands of them. And it was like, well, okay, positioning is the obvious thing. But then I was like, I don't know. Like, I know how to do that in-house. I'm not exactly sure how to do that as a consulting engagement. So it took me a couple of years of working with clients and trying to figure stuff out to figure out how do I take that methodology and use it in a way that works for a client in a short-term engagement. Now I have a thing that's very repeatable. It works as long as I qualify you properly. Like I disqualify a lot of folks that come in because you need to fit my criteria perfectly. But if you fit my criteria, oh, we're going to smash it. I feel very confident about that.
That's a really good point that if you're not disqualifying customers, you're going to have some portion of your customer base. It's going to probably be dissatisfied, not really like you. It'll hurt your overall brand.
And then it's way easier to do that disqualification when you're really clear on what you're good at. So like for me, I've never worked in a consumer business. I got no business touching anything related to consumer. Like my whole 25-year career was like B2B tech companies. If it's not tech and it's not B2B, I'm not the right person. But it's tempting, right? And you got an ego. And people come and they're like, oh, we got this thing. And it's like makeup or something. And you're like, I can do that.
Yes.
But you shouldn't, right? You shouldn't. And it's true. Maybe you could do it. But are you the best person to do it? No, you're not. Like, there's some makeup genius out there that knows how to do this. That I don't know how to do it. So you need the discipline to say, like, even though in my little heart of hearts, I think I could have worked on that. But am I the best person to do it? No, I'm not. And so you just have to be hard no on those ones. So I'm hard no, like if the company's too early stage, the methodology doesn't work. B2C methodology doesn't work. If you don't have a sales team, then we probably don't have the customer information we need to be able to do it. And you need to go do research and I don't want to do research. So you disqualified. There's just a long list of things. And I just hard disqualify all those folks. And I think that's how you build a reputation for great work is you only accept the ones where you know you can smash it. Like, we're going to get together. We're going to do a thing. It's going to be really, really good. If I don't have that feeling, I just say, nah. It's sort of easy for me because I'm just one person and I'm trying not to grow some big 30-person agency. But on the flip side, if you look at what I'm charging and the revenue this thing generates, I don't need to add people in order to grow that thing if I'm really nailing my niche.
I love the stay focused and you can still grow a thing. That's really good.
I'm curious because part of the way you discovered that niche was through your writing and speaking. There's a lot of authors out there. The book market is competitive and you figured out how to break through. It feels like today there's a lot of podcasts and you're on a lot of podcasts. So,
I mean, you know.
You're my third podcast today.
Third today. Are we your best?
Oh, the best. Oh, for sure the best.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Selfishly, I'm kind of curious if you put on your positioning hat and you thought about podcasts, how would you think about positioning podcasts like this one in today's market?
I will tell you that I think the market is crowded. That said, I still think we're in the early days of podcasting. Like personally, I think it's true that we're in the early days of podcasting. And I think there's a lot of room to do creative things with podcasts still. You know, I don't think it's a bad time to start a podcast. I think it's a great time to start a podcast. I think people have podcasts. The flip side of it, though, is a lot of podcasts look the same. Like they look exactly the same. Like if I look at marketing podcasts, I mean, most of them are interview shows and most of them don't have a particular focus. They're just kind of like, I'm going to interview people about marketing things, you know? And so I think that you do have to kind of pick something and say to your audience, you should subscribe because this is the value. This is who this thing is for, you. And this is the value people like you are going to get that they're not going to get in other places, just like you position anything else. That involves thinking about who's the audience you're trying to attract and how is that audience different than the general audience for general podcast? And then how does that change the kind of content you're going to do? So for example, I launched my own podcast. And when I did mine, I was thinking, well, for a long time, I didn't do a podcast because I thought, why would I do my own podcast? Like the great thing about me being a guest is it positions me as the expert. You're the interviewer. I'm the expert. You ask me the questions. That's my positioning, man. And so it was like, if I do a podcast and I'm the interviewer, then I'm not the expert anymore. And I'm like, I couldn't get my head around that. I was like, how's that going to work? Like, why? How is that good for my brand or good for, how's that going to drive any business for me if all I am is the person that asks questions? The idea I landed on was in these kind of podcasts, when I'm here as a guest, we usually have to start with kind of positioning 101 and then build our way up. But there's all these things that if you're a real positioning nerd, I never get to on a guest podcast because we just don't have time to get down to that level. So I thought, well, I'm going to do like a solo show, you know, sort of like Huberman's going to do a whole show on like freaking creatine or something like that. I'm going to do a whole show on me just yakking about, well, what happens in a mature market versus a not mature market? Or what happens when you go from one product to multiple products? Or what's the difference between positioning in a new market category versus very established market category? So I did like 28 episodes and I had the occasional guest come on, but only if we could really geek out about it.
Yeah.
And that was the idea. It was going to be more the two of us, not me interviewing. It was more the two of us are going to geek out about some aspect of positioning, you know, within that thing. And that seemed to work. Like, you know, I only did 28 episodes or something, but I got to the point where my metrics looked like a top 2% podcast, whatever, whatever. And, you know, and I wasn't doing it for very long. I was a bit surprised that there were that many people that wanted to geek out on positioning to that level. That surprised me a little bit. But part of it was, who's it for? It's not for the general people that are sort of interested in marketing or, you know, is it just for like positioning geeks? Like, you're in-house, you're trying to work on this stuff right now. And that's good for me because a lot of my clients will struggle with it internally for months or years, and then they'll come to me in desperation and then we work together. So I thought that's a good audience for me. Anybody that's actually hands-on trying to do it internally, I can help those people, and where I can't, they know me and then they'll come to me. So I thought, but this is good.
I have some scar tissue from that. It's hitting a little too close to home. If you were talking to that in-house marketer today, is there like a favorite episode you have that you would point them towards?
Oh man, like it really depends on where you're stuck. So the folks at the bigger companies get really stuck on, do I start with the company positioning or then I go to the individual product positioning? So there's an episode there that's talking about company positioning versus product positioning. That's one I think that a lot of people are stuck on that topic specifically. There's another one that's about market category. And so right now it's kind of trendy where people think they can just invent a market category. And because they've invented it, therefore there's no competition, which is, you know, ignores how customers look at it. But let's say that's true. And so they're like, well, why can't I just start with the category and then build everything out from there? So I get that question a lot. So there's an episode on that. So I don't know, like there's only 25 episodes or so, and they're short. They're like 20 minutes. People listen to everything on 2x speed. You could probably listen to the whole thing and like walking the dog twice a week, a couple of weeks. I don't know. So there's a bunch of things there. And then same thing with like, I have a newsletter and it's the same thing with newsletters. Like there's lots of newsletters out there. Why would you subscribe to another freaking newsletter? There's too many of them. And the newsletter is the exact same thing. It's the exact same thing as the podcast. It's me going deep on a particular aspect of positioning. You're a positioning nerd. You're in the trenches. You're trying to figure this out. You're stuck on a thing. And I'm going to write 3,000 words on, why can't you just start with a market category? Why can't you do this? Why is it that our positioning does not make the jump from marketing to sales? How do we do a better sales pitch without feeling like a bunch of slimy salespeople? Things like that.
That's such a good point. I love that you're taking the deep approach because I feel like that is the thing that where it's almost like the pendulum swung real hard for the last, I don't know, 15 years. We're getting shorter and shorter attention spans and broader content to where you get enough to get a little bit of interest. But if you really want to geek out, it's actually harder to find.
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting though. Like I've seen people take the opposite approach and be successful too, because they're catering to an audience that kind of wants a broad, like I was recently on this podcast. I don't know if you know the Knowledge Project.
Oh yeah.
Farnham Street.
So Farnham Street. That's fantastic.
So good. But if you look at his stuff, he's done an amazing job of his topic is kind of like how to think. Like it's really broad. It's really broad, but he's kind of like mental models guy.
Yeah.
And how to think.
That's Shane, right?
Yeah. Shane Parrish. Awesome. Yeah. Smart guy.
Another Canadian, right?
Yeah.
Where's with you smart Canadians?
I don't know, man. It's the cold. We got nothing to do. We're trapped in house, reading books, getting smart.
I love it.
But it was great because he lives in Ottawa. I live in Toronto. And he said, hey, like, would you mind doing it face-to-face? And I was like, I'd love to do it face-to-face because you never get to do this face-to-face. So I was coming to Ottawa anyway. And so I literally went to his house and we recorded in his house. It was so cool. But his thing is more like, it's very, very broad. He ain't Joe Rogan. His thing is all about ways to think about stuff, but he's not bound by a topic at all. The episode before me was that body hacker guy. I can't remember his name. Shane.
Oh, the guy who can like control his body temperature?
No, he's the guy that he's basically not making any decisions about his health and he's optimized everything. So he only eats what's prescribed for him to eat and he has had perfect sleep for like 9 months. I can't remember the guy's name.
I've never heard of this person.
It's funny. My son, who's like a teenager, is like, I know that guy, you know, because like teenage boys are all watching this. But anyway, so the guy before was that guy. And so he was talking about optimal health and all the things you can do to optimize your health. And then two episodes later, he's got a different guy talking about nonverbal communication and how can we do that? So this is really, and then I'm in there talking about positioning. Like, I mean, this is a really broad set of topics, but his listeners are like smart people that want to get exposed to a wide range of smart ideas. He's kind of answering this question, like, how do we think about stuff in general? You know, and so he's writing books and his books are all about mental models and all these different kinds of mental models. So I think that works too. So you don't necessarily have to pick a narrow thing and go deep. Yeah, yeah, there it is.
We'll plug Shane's. There's Shane's book. We'll plug two books in the same podcast.
Yeah, yeah. The Mental Models book. I think that works too. It's a different kind of positioning, but it is deliberate. It's thoughtful. And it's not just, I'm going to get some guests and we're going to talk about marketing stuff, you know, or whatever, right? It's more getting very deliberate about, like, if you're to ask Shane, like, what do people get out of his podcast? He's very specific about it. It's for these kind of people that want to get this kind of a thing. A lot of people start a podcast because they're like, it'll be fun and it'll be whatever. And then, you know, we'll go do it. But they're not necessarily saying it's for these kind of people wanting to get this kind of thing.
If I will pull the instant shame out for a minute here, as I think about this show, I started this thing 4 years ago over the pandemic, and it was kind of a pandemic hobby. Like, oh man, I'm an extreme extrovert. I love talking to people. I'm a big coffee. Like, let's go meet in a coffee shop and let's talk about life in your world and business. And I wear a sales hat at SEP. We don't have like an official sales team, but there are 11 people who do what I do at our company. And one of our responsibilities is sales. Well, our business model is so relational. It's not terribly unique. There are a lot of businesses that are very relational, but it just happens to be ours. And so, hey, I want to get to know you as a human being. And I thought, man, a lot of times when I'm having coffee with somebody, I learn something new. There's something very interesting about whatever it is that we talked about. It would be awesome if I just could throw a mic in the middle of the table and just see what happens. Like, that was really where the inspiration came from. And folks that are out there building software, whether they're in product or engineering or marketing, or the folks that you never hear about when you hear of Uber, when you hear of Google, you only hear about the founders. Like, who are the folks that are also doing the work behind the scenes? And what do they need to know? How do they want to grow? What are they facing? What are the challenges that they're hitting up against? And what might help them be better at their jobs? What might help them grow and learn? And so the content and audience has grown over time over the last 4 years. And I'm still trying to figure out how to get more specific because it's hard. I don't know. I have found it to be really hard. Making something simple is hard.
I mean, like, if positioning was so easy, you know,
Yeah. Well,
I wouldn't have to be writing books about it. consulting about it.
I have found it so helpful. It was like, man, we were at this industry and Josh was like, oh, April Dunford speaking. I'm like, cool, who's that? He was like, oh, dude.
She's the Taylor Swift of positioning.
of positioning, yeah, the Taylor Swift of positioning. That's right.
The Taylor Swift of positioning. Yeah, I take that. Taylor Swift of positioning.
My favorite story now to try and when somebody asks about April, I'm always like, let me talk to you about toilets.
That's true.
Because I love that from your book.
Oh, yeah. No.
And you know, so I'm kind of curious. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask if you had any other funny examples of things you've tried to position, but.
Oh, my gosh. Like, so it's funny that when I started talking about positioning, the thing that I found is if I was talking to tech people about a tech example, they would get so distracted by the tech that they wouldn't pay attention to my example. So I'd say, oh, we had a database and then we repositioned it as a business intelligence tool. And they're like, well, what kind of database? You know, and they'd be like that. And I'm like, no, that's not the point. So I started out doing cake versus muffins. That was my first one. It was cake versus muffins. And I was standing in line. I'm in Canada. I'm standing in line at the Tim Hortons. They got in it for, you know, getting a coffee. And there's a big sign. And they're like, try our double chocolate salted caramel muffin with a coffee. And I was like, there's some positioning right there. That is a piece of chocolate cake, but you have put it in muffin form. So it is socially acceptable to eat that for breakfast.
Where do I need to move to get this?
Right. So I'm like, that's amazing. And so there's lots of examples like that, but I used to use that one a lot because I would say, so look at the product. The product is the same features. I'm just putting it in a different context. And so that's what I mean by repositioning. If I put it in the cake context that I'm competing with tiramisu and pie and whatever else you order for dessert, But if I put it over here, now it's competing with a breakfast sandwich or a donut or a croissant. Anyway, so I think, yeah, I have lots of examples like that.
Well, anytime you can use food, that speaks to my heart.
Well, because everybody knows it, right?
Yes.
So food is good. And again, like if I just choose technology things, the tech guys are like, yeah, but that's because it was SQL. Like, let me tell you about the history of SQL. And I'll be like, no.
Not the point.
That's not what I'm going for here, but...
Well, I appreciate your time so much. I know we're here at the top of the hour. I want to respect your calendar. This has been super helpful for me. A little convicting. That's okay. I've got some homework to do.
I think, though, even listening to you guys talk about your own podcast, there's a bunch of elements there already, right? You can hear the elements. It's not about CEOs. It's about a level beyond that. Like, I mean, there's a bunch of things there.
Well, something to go sit down and write down and come back and listen to this over and over again.
Yes. I know this book.
Oh.
You could read.
Is it? Oh, yeah, that one. For anybody that's watching the video version, you can see a book over the shoulder.
That was my April's visual gag for the YouTube watchers only.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure. I hope we get to connect again. I don't know if you're going to industry this year.
I'm going to Industry New York. Are you going to the New York one that's happening in a couple
weeks? I don't think I'm going to be at that one. I think I'm going to go back to the Cleveland one in the fall.
April something. I love the Cleveland one, but I was just there last year. So, you know, they got to give the people a break.
Big plug for anybody going to industry. Head out to the one in New York.
Yeah, go to the one in New York. It's the first time I've done the New York one. So I'm pretty excited about that. That's happening like April 17th or something. So I don't know. By the time this thing goes live, maybe it's already passed. But,
really close.
But I've heard the one in New York is very good. And so I'm excited to go.
Awesome. Well, I hope you enjoy that.
Are you going to SaaStock also?
I am also going to SaaStock, the USA SaaStock one. Coming up in Austin, I will also be speaking there.
All right. Well, you got two opportunities, folks. Go listen to April and buy her books. We'll make sure that they are in our show notes. So thank you so much, April. Appreciate your time.
All right. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
See you.